This is a podcast from ABC Radio Overnights. I'm Rod Quinn.
It's a medical term that, when it's used, people think they know what they're talking about. But do you really know what a coma is? And what would happen if you or someone in your family were in that situation of being in a hospital unresponsive? What would you like your family to do for you, or what kind of treatment do you think that your loved one or family member would need? And what's an induced coma? How does that happen, and how do you bring somebody out of that? We're going to talk about comas, and our guest is Professor Jenny Kitzinger from Cardiff University in the UK. Professor, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
What is a coma? According to your definition of the word coma, what exactly is a coma?
Well, coma is used very generically in everyday conversation to cover anything from being unconscious for a few days, right the way through to being unconscious for many years. But in correct medical terminology, most comas only last a few days or a few weeks at most. And you enter a very different state once you enter the kind of long-term coma known as the vegetative state.
When people also talk about an induced coma, how different is that to a coma that may be the result of an accident or some sort of medical condition?
Well, if you go into coma as a result of an accident that's causing, for example, swelling to the brain, then the coma is a symptom of a serious threat to the brain and an injury. When you're put in an induced coma, it's where medicine is used to make you unconscious, to try and give the brain a chance to heal. So often that means actually the brain is less seriously injured because you're unconscious because of the medication, rather than unconscious because of the severity of the brain injury itself.
How long can somebody be in an induced coma without there being some sort of ongoing effects, side effects, bad effects?
Not for long. I mean, they tend to keep people in induced comas only for a matter of weeks, and then they'd reduce the medication and see whether or not you came into consciousness, because at that point they're trying to test whether you're unconscious because of the brain injury or they've managed to protect the brain enough and you're coming out once the drug sedation is reduced.
What is going on inside the brain when somebody has a coma? I don't mean an induced coma, but a coma as the result of a medical condition or an accident, perhaps when you hit your head. What's actually going on inside the brain?
Lots and lots of damage, basically. It's nothing very romantic. It's a symptom of a very severe brain injuries, and they can be caused from a variety of ways. There are two main categories. There's what's called traumatic brain injury, which is things like a blow to the head, and then non-traumatic brain injury, which is caused by things like suffocation or near drowning. And they have slightly different prognosis. It's much more serious if your brain's been deprived of oxygen than if it's a traumatic brain injury from a blow to the head. But the brain is scrambled and shut down.
When that first happens, are doctors, medical experts, able to tell immediately that this might just be a coma, quite literally, and you're going to be out of it? You would wake from that coma, for want of a better term, within a week or so? Or do they realise that maybe this is going to go on for a lot longer and there's less of a chance that you're going to wake from this situation?
That's a really good question. So it can be fairly obvious that there is serious brain injury. For example, if you know somebody had a heart attack and they weren't under snow, so they weren't frozen, which can protect the brain a bit. So you do look at the cause of the injury and you can make informed decisions based on, well, we know the brain was deprived of oxygen for a long time, for example. But in other cases, it's much less certain. And there's only so much that can be told from the symptoms and from brain scans. So doctors will usually tell families either, well, look, you know, we think from what we know about the injury, they will or won't come out of this. But they'll often also add there's some level of uncertainty and only time will tell.
Is there any treatment that can be given to somebody while they are in this, well, coma is one word that we tend to use, but you say that's not correct, but in a persistent vegetative state? Is there any treatment that can be given to somebody to, you know, try and revive their brain?
Once you're in a long-term or permanent vegetative state, no, but there's a series of points at which you try and intervene. So at the early stage, when someone's in that genuine coma in the early days or weeks, you might try certain kinds of drug treatment. You might try cooling them down, as we've discovered from avalanches. Being cold can help protect the brain. You'd also look for all sorts of things that might be complicating the injury and the level of consciousness, like is there a buildup of fluid in the brain or a growth in the brain that can be operated on. You sometimes do a craniotomy where you take off part of the brain to allow the brain to swell out through the skull. So those are the early interventions. As time goes on, there's less and less chance that interventions make a difference. They'll try putting in a back in, a bit of bone over the hole they've cut in the skull. Sometimes that can help. And there have been various efforts to try different kinds of drugs and treatments and artificial nerves and stem cell, but there really isn't much strong evidence at the moment for any of this making a huge difference.
We sometimes hear about somebody waking after a long time in that state, 10 years, 20 years. Does that often happen, or is it just that we hear about it when it does happen, but for the most part it does not?
Well, yeah, the fact it's very, very rare is why it makes headlines. And when you look at those cases, so I've researched some of those cases, and there are various things going on. Sometimes it's that the person had been misdiagnosed, so they were in fact had some signs of consciousness, but they'd been warehoused and put into somewhere with no specialist care and no attention to their level of consciousness. And maybe they had then slowly shifted out of that state, perhaps in the second year, and nobody had officially re-diagnosed that, although often the families are going, look, we're sure he's responding in some way, but no one paid attention. So there is an issue about the diagnosis and care for patients to be sure that if there is a shift in level of consciousness early on, you do notice, because there can be this very subtle difference between the vegetative state and a condition known as the minimally conscious state. And then the other thing that happens with the media coverage is this shift from vegetative to minimally conscious is sometimes presented as if they woke up and we have this image of a full recovery, whereas actually the person is likely to remain either very low level consciousness or with profound and multiple physical and neurological deficits.
Professor Jenny Kitzinger is our guest. As we talk about comas, or permanent vegetative state is the term that is probably preferred. What about the person that does wake, for want of a better term, after a long time in that state? What kind of condition are they in? Are they able to get up and walk around and walk and talk? What happens?
If you think about this at two levels, so think physically, if you haven't moved for 20 years, you're going to have what's called spasticity, for example, and muscle deterioration and weakness. So obviously, physically, they're going to be in a very, very weakened state. But more importantly, they do still have profound brain injuries. And we forget that when we have romantic stories of people waking up, that they're waking up not as they were before, but as someone who may not be able to talk, may not be able to control their limbs, may not be able to understand the world around them, obviously won't, you know, their memory will be severely damaged and compromised, and they may not be able to kind of do joined up past, present and future. They may just have kind of reactions in the moment.
Why are people kept on life support, as it's often called, when they're in that situation, when there is no chance whatsoever that they will recover? And even if they do, who knows what their life will be like, and we might be looking 20 years in the future. Why is it? Is it only because of the wishes of the family that somebody is kept on life support?
Well, this varies a lot by country. So the first thing I'd say is, of course, some people would want to be. Some people would say, I want to be kept alive on life support, even if I'm completely unaware, because that is a life and existence that would be meaningful to me. So, you know, we have to absolutely acknowledge that and respond to people, what people would want. On the other hand, we also know that the large majority of the population would say, no, I'd never want that in a million years. So the question is, what's happening to people's wishes in relation to this? And the problem is that in many parts of the world, the system kind of takes over and the default is to keep people alive. And of course, families often want to hold on to any hope, any chance that there might be a meaningful recovery. So what many countries are trying to do, and there's certainly big moves to do this in the UK now, is make sure that doctors and the clinical team have that conversation with families that isn't about, do you want your loved one to die, but is, what do you think your loved one would want in this situation? How can we best make sure their voice is included in decisions about whether or not we continue treatment?
Sometimes you hear a story about somebody who is in that situation. The decision is made to turn the machine off, the life support machine, and that person continues to live, sometimes for years. Why does that happen?
Well, this is, depends how you define life support. So life support, people often think of as the ventilator, for example, a machine that keeps you breathing. But there's also another kind of life support, which is the feeding tube, where nutrients are fed in, clinically assisted nutrition and hydration, directly into the stomach. And it's not uncommon in the early weeks, for example, for an assessment to be made that there's not going to be, for this patient, any meaningful chance of meaningful recovery, and a ventilator is turned off. However, it's possible that the patient will still continue to breathe. And then you get into the more difficult situation for many people, which is turning off the machine that delivers clinically assisted nutrition and hydration. And for many families, of course, the fact the patient survives a ventilator being turned off makes them think that maybe the patient wants to live, or maybe there's some drive, or maybe it was not meant to be that they could be allowed to pass. So it can be a very emotional and practical difficulty. And also, clinicians sometimes think differently about the feeding tube machine than they do about the ventilator machine. And laws vary in different countries about turning off that second machine.
How has the treatment of people in this state changed over the last few decades? Has it got any better? Are people, you know, living longer, perhaps, or perhaps are families now more realistic about the situation?
It depends what you define as getting better. There are many, many more people surviving in these conditions than there used to be. This is an iatrogenic state. It is created by modern medicine, in that you couldn't survive in a long-term state without certain kinds of modern medical intervention at crisis point and then long-term to keep you going in this condition. The rapid increase in the number of people has really only happened since the earliest cases were sort of, they really came through in the 70s and 80s, 1970s, 1980s, and now you're getting the very, very long-term survivors. So it's a recent condition. There were problems with that. There were problems with medicine has created a condition and a system is sustaining a condition, which I think we are ill-equipped to deal with emotionally, morally, ethically, and in terms of the medical systems that then sometimes put people on a conveyor belt without really thinking, well, we can intervene, we can keep this person alive. Is that the right thing to do? And what would they want?
How do you think we can do things better?
I'm a passionate advocate for really good communication between clinical teams and families so that families understand as much as they can about the condition, and really good public information about that, I guess, which is why I believe it's good to talk about these things on the radio. I think we as members of the public need to talk to each other. You know, after hearing this program, talk to your partner or your family or a friend about what you think you'd want in this situation and what you value about life and what kind of treatments you would or wouldn't want, you think, in this situation. Even better, write it down. You can often write living wills or advanced decisions or an advanced statement. So I think there's a kind of public education and communication aspect of this. And then there's also a system aspect of this, which is how do the medical systems deal with this condition when they are faced with it? And that means the best possible care for the patient, the best possible diagnostic and prognostic engagement with the patient, and crucially, listening to family or friends of the patient and making sure you've collected information about what that patient would want and that it informs the decision making on their behalf.
So it's in that regard, it's just like organ donation. You need to let your family, your loved ones know how you feel.
Yes, yes, I think that's a really nice analogy.
Professor Kitzinger, thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
And that was another podcast from ABC Radio Overnights. I'm Rod Quinn. Thanks for listening.